this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, CarMax plans second store in Raleigh. And this article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far left, there's a picture of the outside of a CarMax store. The caption on the picture, CarMax offers no haggle shopping at its Glenwood Avenue store. And this article was written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. As used car prices shoot up, giant retailer CarMax Incorporated aims to open a store in Northeast Raleigh, its second in the Triangle. The company foresees a store on 18 acres at the intersection of Capitol Boulevard and Perry Creek Road, a bit more than a mile north of Interstate 540, according to a site map CarMax recently submitted to Raleigh City planners. CarMax has a store on Glenwood Avenue at Ebenezer Church Road in Raleigh, as well as a location on Capitol Boulevard that buys but does not sell used cars. Company spokeswoman Michelle Elwood suggests that the new location could open in late 2014, but wouldn't give a firm timeline. The property is now under contract, Elwood says. The store is likely to employ 50 to 100 people, she says. Since its founding in 1993, Richmond, Virginia-based CarMax has grown to 108 stores. Its revenue grew by 11% to $1 billion in its 2012 fiscal year, which ended February 28. According to its published financial statements. A used car industry analyst says the 2 to 3 years until the new Raleigh store opens is typical for CarMax. They do an awful lot of research on a market before they open, says the analyst, Art Spinella, president of CNW Marketing Research in Bandon, Oregon. CarMax is pitched to buyers as a stress-free experience and a pledge that they'll never feel cheated. The company sets fixed prices, offering buyers a haggle-free experience. It focuses on relatively new used cars, less than 6 years old in most markets, according to Spinella. For that reason, its used cars sell for an average price of $18,995, according to its 2012 annual report. That compares with an average price of $9,062 for all used car sales in calendar 2011, according to the National Independent Automobile Dealers Association. Both figures have been growing by about 5% annually. The price of used cars has been trending upward dramatically in the last couple of years, says Andy Friedlander, communications director for the association. A key reason is restricted supply. Friedlander and industry analysts say the recession cut deep into sales of new cars, which meant owners were holding on to their cars longer. Spinella says the presence of CarMax tends to push up average sale prices for all dealers in a metro area. It's not the result you'd expect from increased competition, but Spinella says it has to do with CarMax's focus on used cars that are relatively new and relatively pricey, along with its no-haggle policy. After a CarMax opens, nearby car dealers associated with manufacturers tend to focus on trade-ins and cars that are 6 to 8 years old. And he adds most independent dealers don't have a lot of 1 to 6 year old car business. Another used car operation with a similar strategy of relatively new cars and no haggle, Auction Direct USA, operates near the CarMax on Glenwood Avenue, but it only has 4 stores in Buffalo, New York, Rochester, New York, and Jacksonville, Florida, in addition to Raleigh. And now moving down the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the next two articles, they take up the rest of the page. They're inside of a black border. The background is an olive background. At the very top, there's a caption that applies to both, in bold black lettering, taking credits. Companies are becoming more aggressive in taking tax credits, but are shying away from credits that require them to produce jobs. Now, in this first, there's one article on the left, a group of pictures in the middle, and another article that starts on the right. In the group of pictures in the middle, the headline on that piece is The Credit Takers. And it says, the following are the top 5 corporate taxpayers and the credits taken under the William S. Lee and Article 3J laws in 2011. And there's pictures of the outside of each company along with the amount. First, Lowe's companies, $11.7 million. CommScope Incorporated of North Carolina, $3.6 million. Biogen IDEC, MA Incorporated, $3.2 million. Wyeth Holdings Corporation, $3.1 million. And Lorillard Tobacco, $2.8 million. Now, the first article on the left has the headline, Lost North Carolina Tax Haul Adds Up to $244 million. And this article was written by Amanda Jones Boyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. North Carolina business owners and investors were able to shave $244 million off their corporate tax bills in 2011 via state tax credits for research and development, renewable energy products, and the purchase of machinery and equipment. It's a nearly 31% increase from the year prior when companies were slashing spending during the recession. Only 4%, or about $10.7 million of the tax credits claimed in 2011, went directly toward the creation of new jobs in the state. And most of the jobs were created before the recession began. If job creation is the intended effect for the tax credits, it's not happening, says Brent Lane, director of the Center for Competitive Economies at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School, who co-authored a 2009 report commissioned by the General Assembly to evaluate the state's economic incentives programs. Dale Carroll, Deputy Secretary and Chief Operating Officer of the North Carolina Department of Commerce, defends all of North Carolina's corporate tax credit incentives as tools for recruiting new and expanding businesses in the state. If, for example, you want to encourage advanced manufacturing, which tends to pay a higher job wage, you need things in your toolkit that provide performance-based incentives for someone who is doing a capital-intensive project, Carroll says. If we're going to be competitive globally, have something that focuses on machinery and equipment is very important. Most of the big corporate tax credit takers are companies that have been operating in North Carolina for decades, and most of their investments were from purchase of new machinery and equipment, not for the creation of new jobs. In 2011, 506 taxpayers filed claims for $10.7 million in tax deductions specifically for the creation of new jobs. But 70% of the credits were claimed under the state's old William S. Lee Act tax credit laws. The Lee Act expired in 2006. But eligible companies had the option of taking tax credits generated under the Lee Act in installments over 5 years. So all of those credits were generated by jobs created prior to 2007. The remaining $3.3 million in job credits claimed in 2011 were under the current Article 3J tax credit program, which can be used to offset up to 50% of a taxpayer's state income or franchise tax liability for eligible expenses such as job creation and investments in business property. Article 3J is set to sunset January 1, 2013, and that is likely to set off another debate over North Carolina's use of corporate tax credits during the General Assembly's short session, which got underway on May 16. Governor Beverly Perdue has included a 2-year extension of the Article 3J tax credits in her 2012 to 2013 state budget proposal, as well as an extension of a sales tax refund on construction materials used at high-impact economic development projects in the state's most economically challenged counties. State projections show that corporate tax collections are forecast to grow by 4.2% in fiscal year 2011 to 2012, which would outpace the budgeted expectations by $56.2 million. Purdue's budget also includes tax credits for companies that hire U.S. Armed Forces veterans and who hire individuals who are unemployed. Carroll notes that through his interviews with site selection consultants across the country, he has learned that much of the research for a company's new location is finished before a call or email is sent to Commerce Department recruiters. There are a number of other states we compete with for these projects, and for those states to have various tax credits and for us not to have them would be conspicuous by its absence, he says. For most companies, though, corporate tax credits are only a small factor among many that go into a decision to relocate or expand its operations, says Cedar Robinson, managing director of the corporate tax consulting firm Warner Robinson LLC in Kansas City, Missouri. They are also looking at things like labor rates and other taxes that might affect their business, Robinson says. But tax credits are always a piece of the puzzle. And now that second article that was also in that same box on the front page. This article is also written by Amanda Jones Boyle with a dateline of Durham. And the headline, R&D credits taken even by a company long gone. Foster City, California-based Gilead Sciences shut down its research facility in Durham in 2010 to cut costs. Yet the company was forgiven $550,000 in taxes owed to the state of North Carolina in 2011. That's one of the wrinkles of the state's patchwork quilt of tax incentives. Under the law, a company qualifying for tax credits may carry forward for 15 years credits earned through research and development and investments in the state, even if the company no longer has operations in North Carolina. R&D credits were set up to encourage the development of new products and services with the ultimate goal of creating new jobs. But companies do not have to document new job creation when applying for R&D credits. They only have to show the money they spend on R&D. By that standard, R&D tax credits claimed statewide in 2011 were up by 63% to nearly $40 million compared to 2010. The spike suggests to some that companies doing research are back in action following a lull in new investments during the economic downturn. IBM in 2011 more than doubled the number of R&D tax credits claimed for investments in research and development at its Research Triangle Park campus. $12 million in tax breaks compared to $5 million in tax credits the prior year. Pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline took more than $4 million in tax breaks for R&D spending compared to zero R&D credits claimed the year before. But new investments in R&D don't always immediately translate into new jobs. Neither IBM nor Glaxo generated new tax credits for job creation in 2011, and there have been widespread reports that IBM has laid off some of its staff in RTP. GSK spokeswoman Sarah Alsbach says tax policy is only one of the many factors that are considered when deciding where to make business investments. Andrew Fisher, chief strategic officer for United Therapeutics Corporation, which claimed $444,800 in R&D credits for work completed at its RTP campus, says R&D credits in general are important in supporting innovation. They are meaningful to any company that receives them, Fisher says. North Carolina is one of 33 states that offer R&D tax credits, says Cedar Robinson, managing director of the corporate tax consulting firm Warner Robinson LLC in Kansas City, Missouri. There are certainly other states with more aggressive R&D credits, he says, but I like the North Carolina credit because it's easy to calculate. A company that spends less than $50 million in research expenses can claim a credit worth 1.25% of the value. A lot of states piggyback off the federal rules, which can be complex, Robinson says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Judge hints Nye was anxious to get CEO's post. A Delaware judge, Leo Strine, issued more than a legal opinion this month in the Martin Marietta Vulcan takeover trial. His summary of the case's backstory highlights career ambition and corporate politics at the core of the acquisition dance. It goes back into the last decade when Vulcan Materials Company CEO Don James contacted Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated's management to talk about a friendly merger. Strine writes, Martin Marietta's then CEO, Steve Zelnak, who remains chairman of the company, was not warm to the idea of any transaction that might involve him not being the CEO of the resulting entity. And the idea of stepping down in favor of Zelnak did not thrill James either, Strine wrote. Enter Ward Nye, who was COO of Martin Marietta at the time and is now CEO. Strine writes that Nye ended up serving for several more years as chief operating officer of Martin Marietta than he had anticipated because Zelnak did not step down as early as Nye had gotten the impression he would. Nye was not at all anxious to find his chance to be a CEO lost in a large synergistic merger. Once at the helm, Nye was nervous but excited at the prospect of a merger. Stein writes, adding to Nye's nervousness was the fact that Martin Marietta had recently been the target of a hostile takeover attempt by a European company that made its move after talks of a joint venture between it and Martin Marietta fell apart. Martin Marietta had escaped that overture only because the financial crisis cratered the bidder's financing. Seen on Twitter from Dell Computer's Michael Dell, big congratulations to our friends at Red Hat News on 10 years of hashtag Red Hat Enterprise, hashtag Linux. We are proud to be your partner. Dell's tweet was retweeted by Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst. Say cheese. Cheeseheads will be out in force in August as Raleigh hosts the 29th annual American Cheese Society Conference and Competition. With more than 1,500 members, the ACS gathers together faithful followers of everything cheese for an annual confab exploring the latest developments in the industry and a competition to pick the best of the best. Cheese, that is. ACS says it supports the understanding, appreciation, and promotion of farmstead, artisan, and specialty cheeses produced in North America. It's now recruiting local volunteers to help with the competitions, registering participants, and even prepping cheeses for tasting. The event will be August 1 through 4 at the Raleigh Convention Center. Last year's event was in Montreal. When Arthur Fonzarelli comes to town, biz pays attention. Tuesday, May 22, is going to be one happy day for fans of Henry Winkler, who is making a trip through the Triangle speaking about a little-known but deeply personal topic, upper limb spasticity, ULS. About a decade ago, Winkler's mother suffered a stroke and developed ULS, a debilitating condition that affects 1 million Americans following a stroke. To raise awareness and its hope to find better treatment options, Winkler joined an educational campaign and will share his family story at WakeMed Rehabilitation Hospital at noon and at the Friday Center at UNC Healthcare at 3:30 p.m. While the term ULS might be unfamiliar, the appearance of ULS, tight curled fingers or arms permanently bent tightly at the elbow or wrist, will be recognizable to many. My mom lived with the condition for 10 years because at that time there was no treatment, Winkler says. The good news, there is now a new tool in the doctor's toolbox and resources available to help manage the condition. Biz's good buds at Band Together raised $552,000 for Urban Ministries of Wake County during the group's May 12 concert at Carrie's Coca Booth Amphitheater, headlined by the B-52s, a.k.a. the world's greatest party band. The money will go to fund Urban Ministries' Open Door Clinic, which aims to provide physician visits, prescriptions, and lab work for many of Wake County's uninsured residents battling poverty. This year's haul was the largest ever for Band Together, which over the years has raised more than $2 million for Triangle nonprofits. Booyah! The Duke University Board of Trustees has approved a second academic program for Duke Kunshan University, the campus in Kunshan, China, that will confer Duke degrees to students there. The program is a Master of Science in Global Health, led by the Duke Global Health Institute, which has offered the MSc-GH degree in Durham for 3 years. The university's academic council approved the program by a 52-7 vote, 2 days before the trustees considered it. The China campus is controversial. In the past year, various faculty members have expressed concerns about academic freedom. Also, in the first 7 years of operation, DKU is projected to lose $77 million, with Duke University having to subsidize half of that cost. The university's partners in China would cover the other losses. In December 2011, the board approved a Master of Management Studies degree offered by the Fuqua School of Business. DGHI also will confer undergraduate courses in global health at DKU and establish a global health research center there. After nearly 10 years as executive director of the International Affairs Council here, Todd Culpepper is moving on and up to become president and CEO of the World Affairs Councils of America in Washington, D.C., effective June 1. The World Affairs Councils of America is a network of grassroots organizations in more than 90 communities across the U.S. The International Affairs Council is a member of the World Affairs Network, representing the Triangle region. IAC's board will begin the task of selecting Culpepper's successor. For those new to the area, in search of an earthy, rural display of Americana, BIS annually suggests the Hillsboro Hog Day. This year, it will be May 18th through 19th. This is the 30th anniversary of Orange County's largest festival, and it's free at the River Park in downtown Hillsboro. On tap are a barbecue cooking contest, music, games, and, ah yes, lots of food. Bayer Crop Science is suing one of its suppliers in an attempt to keep it from backing out of an agreement to supply the key ingredient of a pesticide. Bayer Crop Science, which has its American headquarters in Durham, says Chemtura of Middlebury, Connecticut, agreed to supply the fungicide Iconazole, spelled Iconazole, on an exclusive basis starting in March 2008. Bayer CS developed a seed treatment, Vortex, that used Iconazole as its active ingredient. Bayer CS says it sold Vortex exclusively to Monsanto continuously for 4 years, all with Chemtura's knowledge. But Chemtura argued that those sales violated the contract between Chemtura and Bayer CS. Chemtura threatened to stop selling the Iconazole ingredient to Bayer CS and to start selling to competitors, according to Bayer CS's lawsuit. The lawsuit, filed May 10, seeks a court order enforcing the contract. Bayer's loss of its exclusivity rights with respect to Iconazole will cause it to suffer immediate and irreparable harm, Womble Carlisle attorney Press Millen wrote in Bayer CS's complaint, now pending in North Carolina Business Court. Contributing to Biz were staffers Chris Bagley and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to has the headline, RTP College Campus Could Become Reality. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Raleigh. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far right, there's a picture of a man wearing a tie, sitting at a desk in an office. The caption reads, Wake County Manager David Cook Recommends Bonds. A long-planned campus of Wake Technical Community College near Research Triangle Park would become a reality if county commissioners agree to put a $200 million bond issue on the ballot and voters approve it. Wake County Manager David Cook says the county has the capacity to borrow up to $256 million without having to raise taxes. He's recommending approval of the Wake Tech plan, saying school officials have done their homework in getting it ready. Though it would be in Morrisville, the new satellite operation would be billed as the RTP campus. It was first envisioned years ago but put on hold with the recession. It would account for about a quarter of the total spending in Wake Tech's $210 million capital improvement program. If commissioners agree in July to put the proposal before voters, as is expected, Wake Tech would appeal to voters in November to borrow $200 million for the projects. The county would kick in an additional $10 million from cash reserves. Wake Tech bought 93 acres for the RTP campus 2 years ago. Wake Tech president Stephen Scott now sees the fact that the project stalled as a blessing in disguise, saying a bond issuance is more likely to pass this year compared to last year. Historically, Wake voters have approved projects for the community college. At a budget discussion on May 14, Cook told commissioners the county can afford to borrow the money without increasing taxes, but would then have only $46 million of debt capacity left before needing to increase taxes. That means the Wake County public school system would have to ask for less than that amount, or county taxpayers would face a choice, pay for new projects in the public schools with a tax increase, or possibly reject school projects. But WCPSS does not have a formal plan as Scott does, so a referendum request from WCPSS, Wake County Public School System, likely would not happen until next year. From 2008 through 2012, the public schools issued bonds totaling $693 million. In 2007 alone, it issued $500 million in bonds. Meanwhile, Wake Tech is straining under the burden of incredible growth, spurred in large measure by the recession, which forced people to develop new skills. The waiting list for admission stood at 6,000 in the fall and at 5,800 in January, Scott says. In 1 year, the various campuses will see 65,000 students, including 25,000 for academic training and 40,000 for continuing education. Scott wants to offer more classes, but the rub is the space, he says. The state pays for academic costs such as instruction and supplies, while the county foots the bill for construction and maintenance. In 2011, the state portion accounted for $50 million and the county contributed $16 million. Students paid $20 million in tuition and fees. The new buildings would increase maintenance costs by $3 million a year, Cook estimates, which would be the equivalent of a quarter cent of the property tax rate. If the plan is approved, the county would have to cut that money from elsewhere or raise property taxes. Commissioner Tony Gurley supports a vote on the bonds. I think Wake Tech is the best use of taxpayer money in Wake County, he says. I feel strongly that Wake Tech is an economic engine that will help us get out of this economic recession. Still, he thinks it important to put the matter before the voters. Anytime the county issues large chunks of debt, getting the public's authorization for it is something I think is necessary, he says. And as we move down this same page, we have another article that has a black border around it. Inside that border, first, the top third is a picture. It's the outside of a hospital, looking from the ground up. And the caption reads, and actually it's a drawing, rendering of what will be WakeMed North Hospital. And then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, Hospital Number 5, WakeMed to start $62 million expansion in North Raleigh. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. And next to the article, there's a picture of a man in a coat and tie. The caption reads, CEO Bill Atkinson keeps WakeMed Health and Hospitals in growth mode. WakeMed has put back on track a $62 million expansion of its WakeMed North HealthPlex, a project that will deliver Wake County its fifth full-service hospital to be rebranded WakeMed North Hospital. Work on the 90,000-square-foot expansion of the existing complex off Falls of Neuse Road, north of Interstate 540, is expected to begin soon, with the hospital opening in late 2014 or early 2015. WakeMed intends to keep the current WakeMed North operating during construction, a factor that caused some delay as logistics were worked out. It's just the nature of the beast, says Stan Taylor, WakeMed Vice President of Corporate Planning. Originally, WakeMed had hoped to begin construction in fall 2012 and open as early as October 2013. The biggest addition to the HealthPlex will be a 61 acute care beds focused on women's specialty services, such as obstetric and gynecological services. In the existing complex, WakeMed operates four outpatient operating rooms that are busy, says Taylor, an endoscopy suite for a 19-bay emergency department. By adding the hospital beds, WakeMed can turn the outpatient operating rooms to inpatient ones and perform more kinds of surgeries. Also, WakeMed will add 10 rooms dedicated to women in labor or recovering from childbirth. Really, we are adding a full complement of women's services, Taylor says. The services combined will officially transform the complex into a full-service hospital. Creating a specialty in women's services at the hospital is with reason. According to WakeMed Research Market Research, there are some 6,000 annual deliveries in the area that includes much of North Raleigh. WakeMed wants to capture a lot of those deliveries instead of seeing new mothers drive farther into Raleigh to give birth. The expansion project should give Raleigh's lagging building sector a shot in the arm. WakeMed says construction will create 500 jobs. Employment at the facility will increase from 150 to 442 full-time equivalents by the second year of operation, with an average annual salary of $48,760. The four existing full-service hospitals in Wake County are WakeMed Raleigh, WakeMed Health and Hospitals Main Campus, WakeMed Cary, Rex Hospital, and Duke Raleigh Hospital. Proper prenatal, perinatal, and early childhood care are crucial for the long-term health of a baby. A 2011 study by Dr. Leonardo Trensandi, an associate professor at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and Yingao Liu, a scientist at the National Children's Study in New York, calculated $77 billion in children's healthcare costs related to diseases from environmental causes, particularly lead poisoning and methylmercury exposure. That represents 3.5% of U.S. healthcare costs attributed purely to outside factors. Chemical factors continue to contribute greatly to childhood morbidity and to healthcare costs, the researchers wrote in Health Affairs, an academic journal. In 2009, there were 4.1 million births in the U.S. for a rate of 13.5 births per 1,000 women, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It was the second year the rate declined, and the lowest rate since at least 1980, the earliest year for which data is available. There were 126,845 births in North Carolina that year, also a 13.5 rate. Not surprisingly, the birth rate was highest among women ages 25 to 29, 110.7, second highest in women ages 20 to 24, 107.5, and third highest in women ages 30 to 34, 90.8. Birth rates drop off in age categories outside the 20 to 34 range. Women in the 25 to 29 age bracket in Utah had the highest birth rate of any subcategory in the nation at 163.4 per 1,000. And our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dayline of Raleigh. The headline on this one, banks growing again despite lingering loans. They're still dealing with piles of problem loans, but area community banks were able to chalk up asset growth in the first quarter of 2012. In some cases, the resumption of overall growth reversed quarters of consecutive decline. If the local banks continue this trend of asset growth, that likely will lead to area financial institutions going back to what they do best, making loans, giving credit, and offering stability for its shareholders. At Raleigh-based Paragon Commercial Bank, for example, total assets rose by nearly 2% during the first quarter, ending March 31. They had declined by nearly 25%, in large part because of the sale of the bank's Richmond branch over the prior eight quarters. Meanwhile, at Johnston County-based Four Oaks Bank, which recently posted its first profit in seven quarters, assets rose by 1.7% to $932 million. They had declined by nearly 3% over the prior eight quarters. And at Raleigh-based North State Bank, total assets rose by nearly 6% in the first quarter. When banks' total assets are moving up, it is generally considered a sign of returning health in the industry. I'll compare it to the situation where you got a huge gash across your arm, says banking analyst Don Coker. It bleeds and bleeds, but after a while, it scabs over and begins to heal. We are at the stage when things have scabbed over. A number of factors generally contribute to a rise in bank assets. They take in more deposits and make loans, adding to their capital core and not writing down the value of loans and other holdings as fast as they were before. At some other area banks, total assets rose by nearly 1%. At Fuquay Varina-based Patriot State Bank, by 2.8% at Fuquay Varina-based Fidelity Bank, and by 4% to $225 million at Raleigh's Capstone Bank. Despite the overall growth, non-performing assets, NPAs, many of them loans in the real estate arena, continue to vex. Expressed in terms as a percentage of total bank assets, the Triangle banking industry had an NPA ratio of 4.67 as of the first quarter. That compared to the statewide figure of 4.42%, according to Jeff Adams of Carson Medlin Monroe Securities. For two area banks, their NPA ratios were in double digits as of March 31, Chapel Hill's Harrington Bank was 11.8%, and Smithfield's KS Bank was 10.09%, according to Carson. Four area banks also had so-called Texas scores topping 75, generally an indicator that an institution is under increased asset stress. Atlanta-based Bank Street Partners looks at the Texas numbers of all southeastern banks on a quarterly basis. We divide each state into two categories, those banks with Texas ratios under 75% and those with Texas ratios over 75%, says Bank Street CEO Lee Burrows. In the Triangle region, banks with scores over 75 were KS Bank, 90, Four Oaks, 109.9, Harrington, 113.8, and First Carolina State Bank of Rocky Mount, 225. And now we turn to a page headlined A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. First on the left, there's a column of nonprofit news. In the middle, there's Todd Cohen's Philanthropy News Desk column. And then on the right, People on the Move. We'll start on the left with the nonprofit news. Honeywell Environmental and Combustion Controls employees working with Rebuilding Together of the Triangle are renovating the headquarters of CASA, a nonprofit that provides for the housing needs of veterans and the behaviorally challenged. About 125 volunteer hours will be donated by Honeywell employees, along with a $5,000 investment in materials and supplies. Students participating in Harris Teeter Together in Education's fourth We Think Green contest collected 8,100 bins or more than 7.3 million plastic shopping bags as part of the program and earned cash prizes for schools totaling $6,750. The program is aimed at taking plastic bags out of circulation so they can be recycled. The North Carolina GlaxoSmithKline Foundation has granted $1.5 million to North Carolina Central University in Durham. The money will go toward science and math student scholarships and program enhancements to help increase the number of women and minority students who graduate with a degree in science, technology, and engineering. And now the Philanthropy News Desk column by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, Foundation Raising $10 Million for Wake Tech. There's also a picture of two people in a boardroom, dressed in business attire, standing next to a chart that has the headline, The Ripple Effect. The caption on this picture reads, Wake Tech's Stephen Scott and the Foundation's Virginia Parker have embarked on a fundraising strategy. Fueled in part by the region's economic boom and more recently by the economic downturn, the number of students enrolled in academic or continuing education classes at Wake Technical Community College has surged to 64,000, an increase of 35,000 over the past 10 years. As a result, the school, for each of the past four semesters, has not been able to meet demand from roughly 6,000 people who each wanted to enroll in 2.5 classes on average. Unmet demand is already here, says Stephen Scott, president of the school since October 2003. To meet rising demand, the Wake Tech Foundation has launched the quiet phase of a campaign to raise $10 million to support student scholarships and programs, professional development for faculty and staff, and equipment and technology for classrooms and campuses. Already raised is $1.5 million in a silent phase that began in July 2011. The public phase will kick off in January 2013, says Virginia Parker, Director of Strategic Partnerships for the Foundation. The campaign, which aims to conclude by the end of 2013, represents the first significant outreach to the community, to enable them to invest in their community college, Parker says. Operating with an annual budget of $100 million, 83% of it from the state and 17% from Wake County, the school also receives $50 million in federal loans and Pell Grants for students. Over the course of a year, roughly 25,000 students are enrolled in academic programs at Wake Tech, with another 40,000 enrolled in continuing education programs. The greatest continuing education demand for the past 10 years has been for information technology classes, particularly from students needing certification for licenses for software from companies such as Cisco, Microsoft, and Red Hat, Scott says. Wake Tech also provides training for about 3,000 students through contracts with their employers. And the school provided startup training in 2009 for the staff of Raleigh's new convention center, as well as for a range of hospitality industry employers in advance of the National Hockey League All-Star Game in January 2011. Roughly half the students in Wake Tech's academic programs, an enrollment that has doubled over the past 10 years, are enrolled in technical programs such as plumbing, information technology, and culinary arts. Roughly 25% of all students who enroll at Wake Tech already have a bachelor's degree or higher. The school is on track to serve 80,000 students by 2016, Scott says. Parker says the foundation's target is for more than half of the campaign's gifts to go to the school's endowment, which now totals $1 million. Individuals account for less than 10% of the $2 million the school generates in annual giving, which is divided evenly between cash and in-kind support, most of it from corporations, and those patterns are likely to reflect giving to the campaign, Parker says. The school, she says, plays a critical role in economic growth, a prepared workforce with the right skills, and productive, contributing graduates. And now, people on the move. Safe Child, a nonprofit child abuse prevention agency in Wake County, named the following to serve a three-year term on its board of directors beginning July 1. Kirk Neely and Dane McAlites of Grant Thornton. Marketing professional, Elena Ewan. Community volunteer, Pamela Leitz. Michael Birch of K&L Gates. Linda Douglas of UNC Chapel Hill, Amanda Metcalf of Progress Energy, Kim Mattoon of Peter Millar, Matt Littlejohn of Rutherford, A. Marsh and McLennan Agency Company, Eric Doggett of Doggett Law Offices, Erica Myers of Williams Mullen, Christy Daughtry of the North Carolina Department of Administration, and Lauren Jones of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Also, the following have been appointed officers on Safe Child's board: Charles Raynal, President; Dr. Leslie Marshall, President-elect; Dane McAlites, Treasurer; and Eric Ballinger, Secretary. Longtime Tammy Lynn Center President and CEO Mary Freeman received the Order of the Longleaf Pine. The award is among the most prestigious awards presented by the Governor of North Carolina to individuals who have proven a record of extraordinary service to the state. Freeman retired from TLC May 18th. And our next article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. The headline, LabCorp ordered to pay up in acquired earnings fight. And this also has a picture of two men working outside of a LabCorp office. The caption reads, LabCorp is headquartered in Burlington. In a quirky case that illustrates the risks of basing a final sale price on the acquired company's subsequent performance, Laboratory Corporation of America is having to pony up $4.6 million more than it claimed was due. The acquisition was a relatively small one for LabCorp, a Burlington-based 28,000-employee behemoth with about 1,000 workers in Research Triangle Park. Though the sale price hasn't been revealed, LabCorp agreed in September 2008 to buy a Florida family-owned company called Pagidipati Enterprises. What is known from court documents is that LabCorp agreed to add $2 million to the base price in each of the following 2 years if LabCorp generated certain amounts of income from Pagidipati's former customers. LabCorp said in January 2010 that it did not meet those targets and therefore didn't have to make the first-year payment of $2 million. But it excluded some of Pagidipati's customers from its calculations and didn't let Pagidipati verify its reasons for doing so, Brooks Pierce attorney Reed Phillips, who represented Pagidipati, argued in court. The company sued in September 2010 in federal court for the Middle District of North Carolina. The case was decided without a trial because no facts were in dispute, but rather competing interpretations of law. The May 4 judgment includes the two $2 million payments plus 8% interest. Subsequent payments, such as those agreed to by LabCorp with Paggy DePatty, are known as earnouts, bonus payments that the sellers receive if the acquired company performs well for its new owner. Earnouts are common but frequently lead to litigation. Mergers and acquisitions attorney Amy Davis says earnouts are particularly common when a small company is involved, and particularly when the two sides can't quite agree on a comprehensive acquisition price. But the owners of both companies should use them with caution, she adds. Earnouts are very typical, and earnout disputes are very typical, says Davis of Wyrick Robbins in Raleigh, who was not involved in the LabCorp case. Hutchison Law Group partner Bill Wolford, who also does M&A work, says earnouts, also known as contingent value rights, are particularly common in the technology and life sciences industries. That's because the acquired companies often have unproven products that may or may not end up being extremely valuable for acquiring companies, he says. Phillips, Paggy DePatty's attorney, wouldn't reveal the number of customers that LabCorp got when it acquired Paggy DePatty. The company performed blood and urine tests for physicians, practices, and other medical facilities in 17 counties in northeastern Florida. LabCorp performs a wide range of tests, including for cancer, immunology, reproductive services, and illegal drugs, for 220,000 clients worldwide. It has expanded significantly in the last few years, acquiring Tandem Laboratories in 2008, Monogram Biosciences in 2009, and Genzyme Genetics in 2010. LabCorp representatives didn't respond to questions seeking comment. Paggy DePatty co-owners Divya Paggy DePatty and Rudrama Devi Paggy DePatty, a physician, went on to found other medical businesses, according to the Florida Secretary of State's office. They did not respond to requests for comment. Bronto alums chase $3 million to grow startup. That's the headline on our next article. This one written by Lauren Onsorge with a Dateline of Durham. When Matt Williamson met Brad McGinty in 2006, it was all about Windsor Circle. He sold McGinty his home on Windsor Circle in Chapel Hill, never anticipating that 5 years later, Windsor Circle would be the name of an e-commerce company. The pair were colleagues at Bronto Software, always joking about starting a company together. In 2010, it was no longer a joke. The pair recognized a need for speed and increased personalization in internet marketing, a void they say companies such as iContact and Bronto were not filling. It was an opportunity, McGinty says, an opportunity that, when Williamson quit Bronto in January of 2011, became Windsor Circle. I said, "Today's the day," Williamson remembers. But while the company came alive, it was very lean, operating on an initial angel investment of $350,000. Williamson, McGinty, and their engineering co-founders, Chris Humphreys and Scott Catlin, didn't take a paycheck the first year. To say their families were patient? Understatement, Williams says. McGinty ended up selling that home on Windsor Circle and moving his family to an apartment. Now, a year later, "We've stopped hemorrhaging," Williamson jokes. "We're not liquidating our savings anymore." Windsor Circle's internet platform is one on which online shoppers are given offers relevant to past purchases. While the product has found success, it's modest for now, about 25 clients generating $20,000 in monthly recurring revenue. "At least the paydays have begun again, though not to Pronto levels. We're on partial salary." Partial, Williamson says. The team launched Windsor Circle's first product, a retail intelligence platform, in August 2011. A second funding round of $400,000 followed in December from internal investors, giving the company the cash to hire more people, including sales team member Matt Kilpatrick. "I was impressed with the software and its ability to really drive revenues for companies," Kilpatrick says. Next up is a fundraising round with a target of $3 million, which the partners hope to close within 2 to 3 months. With that, they would expand to 11 employees from the current 4 and beef up sales and product development work. In addition to already presenting to investors at a CED Conference, and the Southeast Venture Conference. They have another opportunity to lure investors, the 2012 Capital Connection. It's a nationally recognized technology conference that selects 26 early expansion and growth stage companies from across the country to present on its main stage May 24 in Washington, D.C. Windsor Circle is the only local company selected to present. Michael Carr, owner of Edge Office in Durham, remains a supporter of Windsor Circle by offering an in-kind service, office space. The startup paid no rent on its space at Edge Office for 3 months until the first revenue was generated. Carr calls the relationship mutually beneficial. A former tech entrepreneur himself, he not only gets to help entrepreneurs, he also uses Windsor Circle's operations to showcase his furnishings. It helps us show what we can do, Carr says. It gives us credibility. And it gives Williamson and Company space to work. Decade-long effort by Duke doctors aims to help Haiti. That's the headline on the next article written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Durham. More than a decade after they first conceived the idea, two Duke health doctors are near to fulfilling their dream of building a medical center in Haiti. The husband-wife team of doctors David Walmer and Kathy Walmer fell in love with the people of Haiti nearly 20 years ago and have made regular trips to help provide medical attention, especially cervical cancer screenings, to those who would otherwise not receive it. In 2000, they decided to build a medical center in the Léogâne province south of Port-au-Prince, where residents still suffer from the after effects of an earthquake that hit more than 2 years ago. The Walmers run the nonprofit Family Health Ministries, which owns 10 acres of land for the medical center. A guest house for visiting doctors is nearly complete, and next will come the hospital and other medical buildings. The total project will cost $11 million, with $1.6 million of that going for the 100,000-square-foot Léogâne Family Health Center, which will have an annual operating budget of $717,000 for operating rooms, family service areas, outpatient wings, and more. Some of the health statistics in Haiti are staggering. For example, Haiti has the highest infant mortality rate in the Western Hemisphere. For every 100,000 births, 630 babies die, compared to 13 deaths per 100,000 births in the U.S. As few as 22% of births occurred in a healthcare facility, and only a quarter of mothers were attended by a skilled birth attendant. In 1993, David Walmer traveled to Haiti on a mission trip with his church and worked with a doctor for a week. He was amazed at how much the doctor could accomplish with so few resources and knew he wanted to help. After speaking with his wife, the two enlisted a group of friends to raise money and help provide medical care. Now, Family Health Ministries has grown to an annual budget of $1.2 million, employs 10 Americans and 70 Haitians, and sees 500 patients at a full-service clinic every year. And it all started with a bunch of friends sitting around a living room, Kathy Walmer says. Hardy Vieu, a Haitian-American and member of the Duke University Board of Trustees, has long supported the Walmers and FHM and now is helping raise funds for the hospital. In Haiti, most of the basic medical needs are hard to come by, he says. A facility like this will assure that the poorest have a place to go. Now they are relying on a makeshift system that really involves seeing doctors who come in from out of the country, and this is meant to provide a means to get regular preventative care. On May 5, FHM held its annual fundraising gala at the Sarah P. Duke Gardens. The total amount raised came to about $50,000, which brings the total for the new $1.55 million surgical center to about $110,000 so far. That is in addition to the $400,000 for the guest house and $75,000 for the 10 acres of property. What appealed to me was how David was able to reach into the country and form alliances with people down there, says Randy Bosse, a friend of the Walmers and supporter of the Léogâne project. What particularly struck Bosse about the project was that it is intended to help get something established, but then turn it over to the Haitian community to run in the future. Haitians are an intelligent, driven people, and they are not looking just for a handout, he says. They might need some initial capital, but they really want a hand up, not a hand out. And with our last few minutes, we'll read some of the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Insight into the Triangle's economic growth. Employment growth in the Raleigh market should exceed that of the nation as a whole in 2012 and 2013, according to a new analysis from PNC Financial Services Group. The Pittsburgh-based bank on Wednesday issued a market outlook for the Raleigh market, which it defines as the Raleigh-Durham, Goldsboro, and Rocky Mount metro areas. PNC projects Raleigh employment growth at 1.9% this year and 1.9% in 2013. That's higher than the 1.6% growth projected for the U.S. this year and the 1.5% growth expected nationally in 2013. PNC thinks the Raleigh unemployment rate will be at 8.5% in 2012. That's higher than the 8.1% projection for the U.S. Progress Duke settle with South Carolina advocate. Continuing efforts to speed final consideration of their $26 billion merger after Federal Regulators Act, Duke Energy and Progress Energy have reached a settlement with South Carolina's customer advocate designed to protect South Carolina customers from additional merger costs. Concessions made by the power companies in the latest settlement and the effective portions of earlier agreements would save South Carolina retail customers $1.04 to $1.08 on every 1,000 kilowatt hours used. That would be close to the equivalent of an average monthly bill for Duke and Progress residential customers, so the savings for them are not particularly large. Krzyzewski paid $7.2 million by Duke in 2010. Duke University basketball coach Mike Krzyzewski earned a nice bump in compensation in 2010, a year the Blue Devils won the national championship. When Duke beat Butler 61-59 to win its fourth NCAA title, the university paid Krzyzewski $7.2 million in total compensation. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. To contact us, our phone number, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.